First, there are Jewish and Christian bombs in the Middle East. But there is no Islamic bomb. An Iranian bomb would strike real fear in both Israel and America. No longer could the West have its way, not with Iran capable of setting off a regional nuclear holocaust. Second, several Muslim countries are vying for supremacy in the Middle East. The leading contenders are Iran, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. Certainly, the Muslim country that goes nuclear immediately emerges as the top dog. Yes, the Saudis have the two holy sites, but we have the nukes, baby. Nukes bring you real respect. 20th century proverb, what do you call a dictator who has nuclear weapons? Answer, sir. So the mullahs desperately want a bomb, and they have the capability to build it. Is there a way to stop them? Actually, yes. It is to support Iranians who are eager to overthrow their repressive government. This does not require an American invasion of Iran or any kind of a direct military operation. Rather, it requires supporting indigenous groups ready to fight for freedom in their own country. This would be akin to what America did with the Afghan Mujahideen who were trying to push out their Soviet oppressors. America did not send troops. But it did send military and economic assistance. The Afghans did the fighting. Afghanistan became what Gorbachev termed a bleeding wound, and the Soviets got out. Is there a similar window of opportunity with Iran? In June 2009, there was. And think of the significance. Iran is the one important country whose government is in the hands of the radical Muslims. Countries like Syria and Egypt, for instance, are under secular rulers. Saudi Arabia and other sheikhdoms of the Gulf are actually fighting their own wars against Al-Qaeda. If America could help eject the Iranian regime, it would be a devastating blow to radical Islam. Not that there have been easy openings to do this, but just 6 months into his term in office, Obama had a rare chance when tens of thousands of Iranians took to the street to protest Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's blatant rigging of the Iranian presidential election. Of course, the Iranian mullahs have been rigging elections since 1979 when Khomeini first came to power. But this time, many people had had enough. Controversy over the election rapidly led to demands for an end to the regime. True, the protests lacked a unifying leader, someone with the capacity of a Lech Walesa or Boris Yeltsin, who could have rallied the people into effective action. Yet with the right kind of encouragement, such a leader might have emerged. So here was a magnificent opportunity for the Obama administration to embrace the rebel cause and actively support efforts to topple the regime. In fact, Obama did nothing. He let the opportunity pass. And while the mullahs were cracking down on the protesters, Obama remarked that they are in the middle of an extraordinary debate taking place in Iran. Debate? I suppose you could call the sight of Iranian police beating up civilians on the street a debate. Obama also specified what he intended to do. We are going to monitor the situation and see how this plays itself out before we make any judgments about how we proceed. In other words, he intended to do nothing. He would wait for the protests to end, and then he would figure out how, if at all, to respond. Eventually, the protests were shut down, and Obama decided that no response was, after all, necessary. So that was the end of that. Having ignored the best chance to stop the Iranian bomb and to help overthrow the regime itself, Obama continues with his laborious exercise of collecting signatures for sanctions. And as we saw in an earlier chapter, there is a second tier to Obama's strategy. Example setting. Obama has managed to convince the Russians that both America and Russia should substantially reduce their nuclear arsenals, presumably so that other countries like Iran will appreciate the gesture and decide not to build their own nuclear weapons. There is a certain preposterousness to all this that Obama's conservative critics have highlighted and even thoughtful Obama supporters have quietly recognized. Anyone who thinks Iran will not build its bomb because America and Russia are paring down their stockpiles needs his head examined. Moreover, the Iranian government is clearly not scared of sanctions. Iran is an oil-rich country, and it can always find a market for this most useful product. Besides, sanctions would only hurt the Iranian people. No one in the Iranian parliament would miss a meal. Not that Iran is even close to having to endure international sanctions. The Obama regime's slow-motion attempts to build diplomatic support for sanctions have only moved the ball a few yards down the field. We are a long way from the goal line. And even if we get there, it may not matter. What, then, is the point? If you plug in the anti-colonial model, you will see it right away. The point is to allow the Iranians to get nuclear weapons while the Obama administration pretends to try to stop them. I'm not suggesting that Obama actually favors placing nukes in the hands of mullahs. Rather, I'm saying that he has no interest in using American power to prevent that from happening. For Obama, it is the huge American arsenal, and possibly the Israeli arsenal, that pose a far greater danger to world peace and stability than a single bomb or handful of bombs that the Iranians may build. For political reasons, however, Obama can't adopt a ho-hum attitude toward an Iranian bomb. He has to make it look like he's doing something. So he selects the strategy that is least likely to work. Actually, from Obama's point of view, it's even better than that. Obama's strategy works beautifully in achieving his own anti-colonial objectives. In denying the Poles and the Czechs missile defenses, Obama weakens America's association with two key allies. Then Obama sits down with the Russians and negotiates steep mutual cuts in the two nations' arsenals. The Russians don't have to do much. Their arsenal is mostly old and decayed. The Russians can just junk some of the old missiles that aren't much good anyway. Meanwhile, America cuts its arsenal by a third. Thus, in the name of building support for sanctions and setting a good example for Iran, Obama has managed to substantially reduce America's military power as well as its links to two small but reliable European allies. Far from being clumsy and stupid, the Obama approach seems to have been both ingenious and largely successful in doing what it set out to do: reduce the power of the neo-colonial United States. If we follow Obama's policies in Iraq and Afghanistan, we see Obama acting with the same singularity of purpose and ingenuity in executing that purpose. This is not to say that Obama always gets his way. He has to operate within the parameters of what is politically possible. But within these goalposts, Obama does exactly what the anti-colonial model predicts. His rhetoric is also illuminating in revealing what he wants to do. We have to read him carefully, because his statements are meticulously packaged for domestic political consumption. But even so, Obama cannot completely hide what he intends, because he needs other people in his administration to actually carry out his wishes. So his packaging needs to have real content. And if we look, we can usually get a peek at what's underneath the fine rhetorical wrapping. Obama's first important foreign policy statement was on October 2, 2002, when he spoke at a rally in Chicago and condemned the looming Iraq war. In the Democratic primaries, Obama was able to use this fact against his main rival, Hillary Clinton. Obama claimed that his criticism of a then-popular but now unpopular war had been prophetic. Obama's anti-war rationale, however, was hardly stable or consistent. During the primary debates, Obama implied that his original opposition to the Iraq War had been based on the absence of weapons of mass destruction. Yet Obama himself admitted in the Audacity of Hope that, "I assumed that Saddam had chemical and biological weapons and coveted nuclear arms. I believed that he had repeatedly flouted UN resolutions and weapons inspectors, and that such behavior had to have consequences." So Obama's view on this matter was actually very close to that of President Bush. Why then did Obama oppose the Iraq War? He told us quite clearly in his 2002 speech, "What I am opposed to is a dumb war. What I am opposed to is a rash war, to distract us from a rise in the uninsured, a rise in the poverty rate, a drop in the median income, to distract us from corporate scandals and a stock market that has just gone through its worst month since the Great Depression. That's what I'm opposed to, a war based not on principle, but on politics." Now, this is an argument that is lifted right out of Lenin's imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. As discussed in an earlier chapter, Lenin's view was that capitalism is in an advanced stage of crisis, but the capitalists have figured out how to postpone that internal crisis by invading and occupying foreign countries and stealing their resources. Thus, in Lenin's view, imperialism is a way to save capitalism and postpone its ultimate collapse. This is also Obama's argument. According to him, the Bush administration is facing disastrous economic problems at home, and therefore decided to invade Iraq not because of any threat posed by Saddam, but to divert attention from domestic woes, and possibly also to ameliorate those woes by seizing Iraqi oil. I don't want to dwell here on the outrageousness of accusing Bush of putting thousands of American lives at risk for the purpose of saving his own political hide. Rather, I want to draw attention to Obama's anti-colonial rhetoric, to show how, in his own words, he portrays the Iraq War as a war of imperial occupation. And this, we will see, is Obama's view of America's presence in Afghanistan as well. So from the outset, Obama has been looking to get America out of those two places. To repeat, this is not because Obama hates America or because Obama wants the Iraqi insurgents or the Taliban to take power. Rather, Obama's primary focus is to curb the rogue elephant that is America, to bring American power under control. This is how Obama defines success. What else happens in these countries is secondary. Obama's anti-colonial mentality is shown in The Audacity of Hope, where he writes that, "When we seek to impose democracy with the barrel of a gun, we are setting ourselves up for failure." This is the anti-colonial critique. Western powers should not try to impose their form of government or their cultural norms on other nations, and certainly not by military force or occupation. That's how Obama views the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, as colonial adventures, inevitably and rightly doomed to failure. But most Americans, not thinking in these terms, would recognize that in the aftermath of World War II, the United States imposed democracy with the barrel of a gun on Germany and Japan. And the results have been excellent. Even using the colonial model, one could say that former colonies that have democratic governments have them because of the example impressed on them by the former colonial powers. There is no other reason why Kenya should have a parliamentary system of government and judges who wear white wigs. We can debate whether democracy is likely to work in Iraq, but clearly Obama's historical lesson about the impossibility of forcing democracy on a country is invalid. But who cares about these historical facts? Obama certainly doesn't seem to. From the outset, he has been doing everything he can to get American troops out of Iraq. That's why, as a United States senator, he opposed General David Petraeus's surge strategy in Iraq and called it a mistake that I and others will actively oppose. He termed the Petraeus plan a reckless escalation and introduced legislation to begin withdrawing American troops from Iraq in May 2007, with the goal of removing all United States combat forces from Iraq by March 31, 2008. To Obama's chagrin, his political stance proved to be spectacularly and embarrassingly wrong. The surge worked, and now Iraq has stabilized. Weeks, even months, go by without a single American death in Iraq. Even Saddam's fellow Sunnis voted in the recent election. The New York Times reports that people are now going to the movies once again in Baghdad. Democracy in Iraq remains fragile, but it is working better than many thought it would under such difficult circumstances. So Obama's problem, once he became president, was what to do about Iraq. He recognized that if he precipitously withdrew American troops and Iraq fell back into chaos, then he would get the blame. Consequently, he seems to have figured that there might be a better way to get the troops out. Wait for Iraq to stabilize, and then say the troops aren't needed anymore. Paradoxically, Obama found that the best way for him to achieve his goal of withdrawal was to follow the Bush policy in Iraq and stay for a while. That's why Obama has continually postponed his date for withdrawal. His current plan is to get around 100,000 troops out in 2010 and the remaining 50,000 or so by the end of 2011. This time he may do it. If he does, he is likely to give no credit to Bush, but rather to claim that his own enlightened approach has finally paid off. Can he once again fool the choir? Count on it. Afghanistan is a tougher problem for Obama. His challenge can be summarized in this way: how to get out without taking the political heat for perceived failure. Let's be clear, a victory in Afghanistan would pose serious problems for Obama. For an anti-colonialist like him, winning in Iraq is bad enough, but to win in Afghanistan would be a nightmare.